This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the September 1987 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Wazwolf by Edward Wellen. Bane melted the dimes and quarters in a crucible, then ladled the molten metal, saw flow from form to morph in a smoothly twisting stream into bullet molds. While the bullets cooled, Bane packed a good charge of powder into cartridges and cleaned and oiled his Service 38. When he could handle the bullets, he fitted them into the cartridges and crimped them in place, then loaded the rounds into the chambers of the 38 cylinder. It was only when the wolf jumped the 6-foot-high cyclone fence to get at the bitch in heat that Bane, stepping between and leveling his gun, remembered the silver content of the clad coins of this day were next to nil. Sticky with sweat, Bane awoke from the same nightmare to the same real world. What he could see of the sky through his window seemed bright enough, but he had the sense of thunderheads lurking just beyond the fleecy, shape-shifting clouds. He took his time getting out of bed. No sudden moves. He was aging and had learned that rising too quickly left the blood behind, made him black out. He listened to the radio that had wakened him. The announcer, giving a cold reading of hot news, stumbled over foreign place names. Made no difference. When it came to human-made and human-suffered catastrophes, countries were interchangeable. Bane shoved slowly to his feet, straightened up, stooped. Bane tried to smile, but his face felt stiff. Nothing to laugh at as long as the task he had set himself stayed unfinished. He had solved the case years ago, but never resolved it, and now his flesh, his bones, his very soul were telling him not all that much time remained to him if we were to bring the culprit to justice. Time, the thought passed over him like the shadow of a bird. High hysterics on the part of the radio, a voice announcing the sale of appliances at unbelievable prices, brought Bane into the here and now with a shiver. Bane snapped off the sound and smiled sourly. He believed the voice when the voice said unbelievable. Lots of things, maybe even most things, were unbelievable. Even Bane's own inner voice could be unbelievable. After 18 unrewarding years of watching the Lupruscues and their dog, 18 fruitless years of spying on them from just across the fence, 18 wasted years of looking for some telltale sign, some giveaway slip, some momentary lapse, Bane could no longer swear to what he believed. He put himself on the stand. Had he personally started to split along the grain? And examined himself crossly. Do you mean to tell this court that after all these years, you can be sure you saw what you say you saw? Remember, you're under oath. Bane remembered the suddenly ravaged faces of the Lupescus. He could look back and see them age, a decade in the 10 minutes it took him to convince them that he wanted their son for rape and murder. And yet he had read something more than, or something other than, fear in their eyes. He had read a sorrowful yet prideful look of complicity. That shared look said plainly that they felt sure their son was safe from harm. Holding their heads high, they let him search their house from attic to cellar without a warrant. They had nothing to hide, they said, and they stood passively and quietly by, petting and soothing their dog that snarled and would have snapped at the intruders while Bane and his partner all but tore the house apart for hiding places and ransacked the rooms for clues. True, the Lupescus seemed shaken when Bane showed them the murder weapon came from their carving set, and their faces went stony when he turned up blood-stained shirt and semen-stiffened pants in a hamper. But they clung to one another and to their stubborn and almost gloating certainty about their son's immunity from prosecution, even if they no longer asserted his guiltlessness. There was no question in Bane's mind he had found or at least followed the perp. The patrol car had surprised the rapist, finishing off his victim with a knife, frozen him in the spotlight for an instant, then given hot pursuit when he took off down the alley. Bane, lighter and quicker back then, chased him on foot, over fences and through hedges, crookedly straight to the Luprescu's house. And there the perp vanished. Bane saw the youth drop the knife to climb the oak in the backyard, watched him leap through an open window into what turned out to be Val Lupescu's bedroom. At that very instant, Bane's partner, clued by Bane's walkie-talkie, pulled up in front. Almost immediately, other cars and officers, responding to the broadcast squeal, surrounded the block and sealed off the area. So, where Val vanished to puzzled Bane. The Lupescus stood with their bristling dog and watched the search substantiate Val Lupescu's disappearance into pale, moonbeamish air. To Bane's eye, the animal looked more wolf than dog. Bane remembered the shock when he first glimpsed the malevolent intelligence in the topaz eyes. He remembered putting his sweaty hand on the grip of the Service 38 in his holster, his fingers itching for the beast to go from fangy growl to flowing leap, remembered raising his chin, his bare throat inviting the beast to spring. But the dog smiled, though Bane met out red hunger back of its jaws and held itself tightly still. Not till later, once the impossible thought lodged in Bane's mind, did Bane think to check with the neighbor on the right. The house on the left was vacant and up for sale. Whether the Lupescus had a dog. The woman seemed half blind and half deaf and would have been wholly useless on the witness stand, but she did say she couldn't say as she'd ever seen or heard a dog on the Lupescus premises. By the time a few days later, when Bane asked the Lupescus where was the dog's collar and its leash and where was its license, the dog sported a collar and a tag that said its name was Fire, although the Lupescus pronounced it Fira, and the Lupescus produced the receipt for a paid-up license. That left Bane with a crazy theory he didn't dare voice. Didn't mean he didn't dare follow it up, but he had to follow it up on his own time and in secret. Secret, at least from his bosses, who seemed satisfied the department had done its duty in putting out an all-points bulletin on Val Lupescu's, age 15, height 5'10", weight 150, pale complexion, dark hair, topaz eyes, and by following up with wanted posters. As soon as the story died in the media, the department seemed content to let the case folder gather dust and crumble to the same in the inactive files. Bane's chief, the one time Bane tried to convince him to keep it open, shrugged and said the Lupescu's kid was bound to come to a bad end in the world of runaways, one way or another. Val would get what he had coming to him. Not secret from the Lupescus, Bane wished them to know he was still and always after Val, for only by rattling them or wearing them down could he prove his crazy theory. Bane felt so strongly about it, so driven to show himself he hadn't gone wacko, so determined to make Val pay for the crime, that he took early retirement and moved not to the Gulf fishing Florida of his dreams, but to the house to the left of the Lupescus. Bane had lived alone ever since his wife walked out on him and got the divorce he never fully understood her reasons for wanting, and he had no one but himself to answer to. In the radio's silence, Bain heard the Lupescu's car start up and pull out of their gravel drive. He padded to the window to see who all was aboard. Sometimes they took fire, sometimes they didn't. When they did, Bain would tail them in his own jalopy. When they left fire home, Bain too would stay home and use the absence of the supportive parents to torment fire to the utmost. This morning, the parents were alone. Sometimes they were cute and seemed to be alone, but fire crouched on the floor in the back. This morning, though, Bain caught sight of fire, stretched up to stare out the parlor window at the car shaking the gravel from its tires and vanishing down the street. Dust hung in the air, no breeze, and another hot one. Bain rubbed his facial bristle, but decided against shaving, even though he'd feel cooler without it. Used to be, while he was on the force, he had to shave twice a day, and yet still powder to mask the bluish look. Now his beard had grayed, so he could get by with shaving every other day. He put on pants that had long since lost their permanent press, and let his shirt hang over his waistline to hide the zipper-exposing give of seams at the top of the fly. From the dresser top, he picked up and distributed in his pockets his keychain with the dog whistle fastened to it, a few sheets of facial tissue, his billfold and handful of change, and the police shield and service revolver he had hung on to. He went to the kitchen for a six-pack of beer from the refrigerator and carried the six-pack out onto the front porch. Everything about him seemed heavy. Heavy features, heavy build, heavy walk. He made for the fraying wicker chair and seated himself heavily, as though tired. Then he faced the Lupescu's house and came to life, at least in the eyes. He switched on the portable fan to waft his scent towards the Lupescu's house. Fire must have had warning before that, must surely have heard the screen door squeak and the floorboards groan, but stayed stretched and immobile as though posing for a portrait of man's best friend awaiting man's return home. Now he slowly turned his head to meet Bane's gaze. Bain popped a top and chug-a-lugged, crushed the empty in his hand, and made suddenly to hurl it at the window Fire looked out of. Fire did not twist away, stayed put and just kept looking straight at Bain. Not that Bain had expected anything else. Damn monster knew Bain knew better than to lay himself open to a charge of malicious mischief. Bain had taken care all these years to stay within the law, or at least to restrict breaches of the law, to measures only Fire could testify to, only if Fire transformed back to Val. Measures such as blowing the dog whistle with its sounds above human range. Bain let the empty fall to the porch floor. He drew out the dog whistle on his keychain, made a swipe at his mouth with the back of his hand, and put the whistle to his lips. Now Fire twisted away from the window and dropped out of sight. This Bain had expected. Bain was never sure exactly where the sound drove Fire, under a bed or deep into a closet, but he felt sure it did drive Fire mad. The howling told him so. If Bain had not been the cause of it, the howling would have been enough to drive Bain mad. But he was in control of it and could make it keep up long past what otherwise would have been his own limit of endurance. The howling had been bad enough for the half-deaf woman who lived on the other side of the Lupescu's to complain to the cops and the SPCA about, blaming the Lupescos for neglecting or mistreating their newly acquired pet. Nobody but Bain and Fire and maybe the Lupescu's knew of Bain's hand in it, Bain laying off whenever anyone came next door to investigate. But that was in the beginning. The neighbor woman had died 10 years ago, and the couple who bought her house were away at work during the hours Bane blew the whistle and fire howled. These days, as right now, Bane blew it more out of habit than in hope. Give the son of a bitch credit. Fire had never let the torment drive him out of his shape, force him from dog horn and dog hearing, at least so far as Bane knew. A few more blasts now, then Bane let up for the time being. He had worked the six-pack down to zero by the time the newsboy rode by, sailing papers onto the lawns. Bane waited for the next part of the ritual. Anyone who didn't know what Bane knew would have thought that Bane, that the Lupescus had trained their dog well. Fire exited the house through the swinging panel cut into the lower half of the front door. With side glances Bane's way, Fire trotted to the paper, picked it up in his jaws, and headed back for the door. Bane pushed to his feet and moved to the porch railing nearest the fence. "Hold it, Val. Come here to the fence. I want to talk to you." The dog did not pause. Bane's voice took on a hard edge. "Want me to blow the whistle some more?" Bane veered and stalked stiff-legged towards the fence. "That's a good boy." Bane bared his teeth in a grin. "Like to go for my throat, wouldn't you?" Bane half hoped that the dog would try just that. Oh, there was little likelihood. The fence stood too high for a dog, or even a wolf, to overleap, but it would have been satisfying to see Fire try. Bane's hand in his pocket was on his gun. God, to be able to say, "Nice try," and shoot. End this the right way, once and for all. Bane stood still, but the vise of his jaws tightened on the paper. Bane grimaced and shook his head. "When you gonna give it up and change back? I have to say, I never thought you'd stick it out this long. Maybe if I could have seen this far down the road, I might not have started this, what, dogging you, hounding you?" He chuckled. "Good, huh? Yeah, wolf. You can't keep me from your door." He shook his head to clear it for what he meant to say. "But what I called you over for was, don't you think it's time we had it out?" He grew earnest. "Right now, before your folks come home from shopping. Aren't you sick of those cans of dog food and the flea collars? Right now, while it's just between the two of us, can't you be man enough to face up to what you did? As a man?" Bane told himself that the dog looked weary and worn, had dull coat and lackluster eyes. But the dog, the animal that looked more wolf than the German shepherd it passed as, panted quietly around the newspaper and gazed at Bane with disdain. One last try to reason with the monster. "We can't change what's deep down. You're what you are, and I'm what I am. Tell you right out, I'll always be a cop, always be looking to nail you. But just what are you? Something that doesn't have the guts to get up on its hind legs and be the man you started out being? Or are you, Val? Could you be yourself again? Or have you forgotten what your true self is?" Fire stood unmoved. Bane gave a sharp gesture of dismissal. Fire raised a hind leg and took a territorial leak on the fence. Bane's temples throbbed. This was what they called seeing red. He pulled his gun and leveled it at Fire. What could they get him for if he shot a dog? Nothing, really. At most, a fine. Almost, he squeezed off the shot. But it wasn't a dog he was after, it was a man. It was as a man that Val had to get his. Bane put away his gun unfired. He didn't know what a wolf dog's peripheral vision was, didn't know if Fire had even been aware of Bane taking aim at him. Bane watched Fire trot unhurriedly to the door opening and shove himself inside with the Lupescu's newspaper still firmly in his jaws. Heavily, Bane negotiated the sagging steps of his porch to pick up from his scraggly lawn his own copy of the daily paper. He plunked himself down in the wicker chair and skimmed the news. The second section featured travel and leisure. Bane grimaced at a shot of a record tarpon and the proud sportsman. He turned the page with a snap and fixed on a bevy of beauty queens lined up for a contest. What smooth flesh! What dangerous curves! Bane shot a glance towards the Lupescu's house. What was fire making of this? Could a dog's eyes make sense of the dots? Why not? Bane knew dogs made sense of the lines on television screens. If fire's eyes were looking at this picture, what was Val's mind thinking about it? What were his gonads doing? Bane rolled the paper into a bat and smacked it against one palm. By God, that was the way to go. He got to his feet too fast, swayed a second, but the wave of blackness passed away. He moved more slowly into the house and into the kitchen. The draw was the magnet-held calendar on the refrigerator door. His eyes picked out this month's phases of the moon. He smiled back at the sketched smile of a full moon. Luck was with him. Fate was on his side. Full moon tonight. Fire would be out on the Lupescu's lawn, pointing his nose at the moon. Bane stepped lightly to the bathroom where he took his time shaving. The third bar he hit was the right one, just as sleazy and noisy as the other two, but it was the one where he found the girl he was looking for. Not the girl as such, but the type girl. One young enough and pretty enough and curvy enough, and one like enough to the girl Val had raped and butchered 18 long years ago, but one dumb enough to believe the shield Bane flashed still meant what it said. He flashed his wad first and bought the watered drinks she'd be getting her cut on. Her dress clung to her, where she didn't burst out of it. Her hair was piled high on her head. She clanked with junk jewelry. He gave a guy who wanted to horn in a hard look that made the guy drift. Her lips parted. Her eyes shone. Bane and the girl sat alone together, squeezed in a corner booth, and he led her on till he could get her for soliciting. In spite of thinning, the drink still packed enough proof to make this Brenda, the name she claimed, look even better as the evening wore on. But he wasn't out to work up and satisfy his own lust. He had her in mind for Val, the man in the dog, for the beast in the beast. And when the waiters started upending the chairs on the tables, Brenda said, $30 for an all-nighter. Your place or mine, and he had her. She looked around and raised her eyebrows at the precautions he had taken. Why do you have that big high fence all around? He kept his eyes roving as he unchanged the gate in the fence and let himself and Brenda in. Didn't spot fire yet, but it wasn't high full moon yet either. Not only that, I have traps you don't see and poisoned bait. That much was true. But Bane never really wished that these would do fire in. Bane made a fine distinction. It mattered that Val die like a dog, if not as a dog. But no punishment, no death, seemed enough unless and until Val face it as a man, if not like a man. Bane rechained the gate from the inside and gestured Brenda to follow him onto the porch and into the house. There's a mean dog next door that would just love to tear me apart. Brrr, she gave a delicious shiver. Aren't there laws against keeping vicious animals? Laws against soliciting, too. She flushed. You can go after me. Why can't you go after the dog? I am, in my own way. He let them into the house. He burned a bit with shame at the mess the place looked, though he felt sure Brenda had seen plenty worse. In fact, be honest with you, that's what this is all about. I don't understand. You don't have to understand. You just have to do what I tell you to do. She didn't understand what he had in mind and gave him an arch look, but she went along when he told her what she had to do. Anything must have seemed better than a bust. So he didn't want a score, didn't want any specialties. All he wanted was for her to lounge on his porch in her slip. She shrugged and said, okay, if that was all it took to keep him from taking her downtown and booking her, that seemed a small price to pay. Maybe her way of getting back at him was to tease him by asking her to help her unzip, and by rubbing up against him while he fumbled for the tab, and by letting the shoulder straps of her slip hang loose after she shimmied out of the dress. That was all right with Bane. The more stirrings he felt, the likelier Val would feel something. Let Val get an eyeful. It took an hour longer before Val got the eyeful, and then it was Brenda, not Bane, who spotted him first. Bane crouched hard by in the shadows, but was dozing. At this point was having a sharp exchange with himself. What do you mean a leopard can't change his spots? If he leaps from here to there, of course he changes spots. When Brenda's gasp snapped him too, she cast a reproachful side glance at Bane. That's a fine-looking doggy. He don't look mean at all. And indeed, Fire sat quietly and stared soulfully, not at the moon, but at Brenda. He had let himself out through the swinging panel of the Lupescu's front door and come right up to the chain-link fence without a sound reaching Bane's ears. Guess the old hearing was going, but Bane smiled, watching Fire sit there like that. It was going to work. Suddenly he knew it was going to work. He held his breath as Fire reared up and stretched full length against the fence. Fire fixed his topaz gaze on Brenda. Bane couldn't tell from here whether Fire's mouth slavered, but he could see the tongue flicker, and he could see Brenda begin to get the message. She threw her words over her shoulder as though she could not tear her eyes from Fire. Hey, this dog looks like he's going to go for me. Bane whispered gently but urgently, don't panic. I'm covering you. Just stand still so you don't step in the line of Fire. Fire dropped to all fours and backed away from the fence. For a second, Bane feared that Fire had heard him and that prudence was overriding prurience, and Bane cursed himself under his breath. But Fire withdrew far enough for a good running start, gathered himself, and came charging. He threw himself upward, and when he saw he couldn't clear the fence, pulled back for another try. Brenda turned trembling to face Bane. Stand still? Hell! What kind of kinkiness you into anyway? If that crazy dog comes over the fence, I'm running inside the house. He can't come over the fence. Not as a dog, he can't. Brenda gaped at him. What does that mean, not as a dog? Fire, Val, answered her by metamorphosing, flowing from form to form. The wolf dog, with a painful lengthening and rearticulating of bones, a transforming of fur, became a naked man, pale and ghostly in the moonlight. The man stood tall, walked jerkily to the fence, and began to climb. The man's eyes fixed on Brenda. From deep in the man's throat came long, unused sounds, trying to shape words. I love, I hate. For God's sake, Brenda's cry broke the spell for Bane, though she herself seemed too stunned to move. Going for his gun, Bane rose swiftly out of his crouch. No sudden moves. His blackness tapped at him. What had he done? Spent all those years breathing down the killer's neck only to set up a poor doomed hooker for rape and disembowelment, got to get Gal before the blackness washed over him. Maybe inside, Val still felt youthful. After all, he'd be only 33 years old if he'd stayed human all along. But in the measurement of wear and tear, a dog's year is the equivalent of 7 human years. 7 times 18 equals 126. No wonder Val looked kind of sheepish as his strength failed him, and he stood all frail and wrinkled in the sight of the astonished girl just before falling away from his grip on the fence and collapsing into dust. We continue with a story from the October 1987 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is The Colonization of Edward Beale. Edwin Beale was looking forward to the end of the world. Not just any end of the world, however. He had no use for the idea of nuclear war. That ending was too final by half. He didn't want all life wiped out, just most of humanity. It wasn't the destruction of the physical world that he craved, but the end of civilization as he knew it. Driving home from work each day, Edwin customarily passed a boundary sign that declared the London borough of Brent a nuclear-free zone. It made him sneer when it didn't make him sad. It was so pathetic, individuals imagining they could opt out of humanity's collective madness if the worst came to pass. He thought of the county councillors and all the inhabitants of Brent sleeping soundly in their beds, imagining that now the target would be painted somewhere else, imagining they would survive intact when London burned around them. Sometimes, as he labored in the mills of the large American computer firm that paid him so well for designing software, Edwin toyed with a nuclear scenario, imagining some terrorist organization bombing New York or Washington. It would have to be an indigenous American group, however, or what was left of the American military-industrial complex would take vengeance on the evil foreigners, and American vengeance would lead inevitably to global war. London would go if there ever were such a war, and with it, all of Britain. Edwin did not imagine that even he could survive a nuclear holocaust. And survival, for Edwin, was what he was all about. Financial catastrophe would be better. Collapse of the stock market, of the worldwide monetary system. Everyone would head for the hills then, but Edwin would have a head start. At least he hoped he would. Crawling home through the miserable London traffic on Friday afternoon, somehow it never mattered how early he left on Friday. It seemed as if everyone else had the same idea at the same time, and the rush hour started then. Edwin thought impatiently ahead to the narrow, rather decrepit house in Haringey that he called home, and visualized letters lying on the mat, letters with airmail stickers and stamps from Australia or America, some positive response to all the job applications and inquiries he had dispatched must be forthcoming. He had imagined it would be easy. After all, he had a skill, and he wasn't picky about where in North America. Australia was second choice, or with what company he got a job. But if there were jobs in America, they were not for him. No one was willing to import him, and Edwin was beginning to feel that time was running out. He was having dreams, telling him the end was near. He was terrified of leaving Britain too late. He had to escape, had to get off this tiny, crumbling island to survive. He had to save himself. When he was younger, Edwin had imagined running away to Scotland or Wales and surviving there after the collapse of civilization. He had devoured science fiction stories about new ice ages, or the death of grass, of plagues, wars, and alien invasions, and had determined that when things began breaking down from whatever cause, he would be on the road to the north, pack on his back, ready for a new life in the wilderness. But now that he had acquired the survival skills he had once only imagined, and had spent several rough Highland holidays, Edwin no longer found Scotland satisfactory. It was too close, too small, like all of Britain. Once the cities started to go, people would head for the country, and there were bound to be too many who would have the same idea as Edwin. No, he wanted the space and emptiness of a whole new continent to fill himself. He wanted to be a new pioneer. A whole new planet would be even better. But although he still read science fiction, Edwin had not, since his teens, seriously believed that this was a possibility open to him. Even if, say, a faster-than-light drive were invented, the resultant space program would be too late for him. He would be too old, and probably of the wrong nationality, to be picked as a participant. He would have to make his own opportunity on this earth. There was a parking space directly in front of his house. This was so rare that Edwin took it as a sign, and indeed, when he opened the door, he found 3 airmail letters. But all of them, when opened, provided only disappointment. They were formal notes thanking him for his interest and expressing the ritual regret that there were no openings for him. Edwin went on standing in the dark, rather damp little entrance hall. He could hear voices, not in English, from next door. He didn't even want to go upstairs and log these replies and check on how many more chances he still had. But there were other ways to get what he wanted, Edwin told himself. He had a fair bit of money saved up, and he could sell his house and go to Canada as a tourist to vanish into the North Woods when his visa expired. It was possible, too, he thought, that in America the collapse of civilization was not so imminent as it was here. Perhaps it was only Britain that was collapsing, and if he went to America he would miss it all. These thoughts cheered him, and Edwin set aside his mail and went down to the cellar to change into his gardening gear, planning to get in a couple of hours of work before dinner. Outside, the routine labor of digging in and breaking up the soil left his mind free, and his thoughts slipped all too easily into a well-worn fantasy. The smashing of windows and bottle glass, a strong smell of petrol and licking flames, hoarse, violent voices shouting, not in English. He'd left his escape late, but he had everything he needed in his rucksack, always ready at a moment's notice. He didn't think he would have to fight his way out of the city, but he wouldn't have minded. Nobody paid any notice to him, long, strongly built white man walking purposely through the mad confusion of the streets. They were all too busy with their looting and raping. A woman's scream, it was Jennifer from the office. She was surrounded by dark-skinned youths pulling at her clothes. He glimpsed a breast and her pale, terrified face, heard their coarse laughter. He needed no weapons but his fists. Well, maybe a broomstick would be better, snatched up, deadly in his hands as, but there were 4 of them, maybe 5. The gun slipped easily into his hands without even the memory of having drawn it. It fit there as if not a handgun, but something bigger. He wore it slung across his back. He wouldn't even have to shoot them because the mere sight of it. Edwin thought of the ads in Soldier of Fortune magazine and longed with a hopeless passion for America. It was so easy there to have a gun. Everything would be easier in America, including, no doubt, the women. Jennifer's pale face, adoring and grateful as she clung to him panting. Jennifer tearing off her blouse, the lacy white one, to bind his wound. It was only minor, but One of her attackers had cut him with a knife, and Edwin had been forced to shoot. He wanted to explain to her that he wasn't violent. He didn't like to kill, but he'd been forced. He'd had no choice. But she stopped him talking with her delicious mouth. In his excitement, Edwin stabbed the fork more deeply into the earth than was necessary, and then jarred back on his heels as he struck something hard. Frowning, he stabbed again exploratively. It seemed much larger than any rock left in this garden, after all the years he had worked it. Should be the size of a football, at least. He could have left it, but curiosity drove him now. He wanted to bring it up and see it, so he threw the fork aside and began to dig with the shovel. The light was nearly gone by the time he brought the thing out, but even in full daylight, Edwin wouldn't have known what he held. It was not a rock. Beneath the clinging dirt, the surface of the thing was hard and shiny, rather like plastic, and a mottled brown and yellow color. It was about the size of a soccer ball, nearly as round, but heavier. Edwin frowned at it, tapped at it with a fingernail, and listened to the not-quite-hollow click. He tried to clean the dirt off as he speculated on its intended use. What is it, a children's toy or some bit of decoration? How had it come to be buried in his garden? It was seamless, he thought at first, the surface flawless beneath the soil. Then his searching found a slight concavity, a small depression in the hard, slick surface of the globe. He pressed it with a fingertip, fancying that it gave slightly to his touch, and then, with shocking suddenness, it opened. His finger slipped inside, quite without his intending it, and as he jerked his hand back, he let the thing fall to the ground. Edwin stood a moment, breathing hard, trying to understand. It was nearly dark. He decided to take the thing inside, to get a better look at it. He pushed at it with his foot, making it roll, trying to see the opening, but there was no sign of it. He was nervous about picking it up, fearful that it would open again for his fingers, but he managed to conquer his fear and carry it into the kitchen without mishap. There, he cleaned it carefully with a damp sponge and found no cracks, no indentations, no flaws whatsoever in the smooth, now shining surface. He raised it closer to his face, squinting slightly, and suddenly he thought he saw it, a darker spot against the mottled brown. It opened like a mouth, and something shot out, something like a worm or a snake or a turtle head extended itself from the opening and bit his nose. Edwin screamed and was ashamed of the noise as soon as he heard it. Having struck, the thing retreated. Edwin was holding a hard plastic ball without any apparent holes, flaws, or openings. It might have been a dream except for the throbbing of his nose. Carefully, he set the ball down on the draining board and went upstairs to the bathroom. He was shaking. Although his nose hardly hurt at all, he could see in the bathroom mirror that it was very red and swelling rapidly. He stared for some time at his own reflection and prodded his nose, but no understanding came to him. He went back downstairs and stared at the thing from a safe distance. What could it be? Some sort of tortoise? He'd never heard of anything like it, and he'd always been a fan of television nature programs. He was certain it didn't belong in England, but even as some more exotic creatures, it seemed unlikely. Perhaps it belonged to the sea. It couldn't be some grossly outsized insect. Perhaps a carnivorous plant? He would have to find out. On Monday, he would start phoning around. For a moment, he was almost sorry it was a weekend, since that meant he'd have the thing around, a mystery, for 2 days. If he could have brought himself to touch it, Edwin would have put it back in the garden. But he decided discretion was the better part and left it on the draining board. He was careful to close the kitchen door, shutting it safely in, before he went up to bed that night. By then, The lump on his nose had grown quite alarmingly large, but it still did not hurt. Edwin decided he would visit the doctor in the morning. It wouldn't be to be too casual about an animal bite, particularly when it might not even be an animal that had bitten him. Perhaps there was some infection, he thought, as he settled rather shakily between the sheets. He certainly felt feverish and sank at once into strange dreams. Jennifer from the office was biting his nose. He slapped his hand beneath her sweater, only to find her lovely, large, soft breasts encased in a hard shell. He pressed and pressed at them in frustration, and finally they yielded to him. They opened like mouths and bit his hands. Jennifer was biting him all over, and he was in an ecstasy of painful lust. Tormented beyond endurance by her teasing, he grabbed her head and forced it to his groin, but even as he moaned in happy anticipation, feeling her mouth on him, Edwin was aware that something was very wrong. Jennifer's head had no hair on it. Jennifer's head was hard and shell-like, and Jennifer's mouth, nibbling at his cock, was quite the wrong size. It wasn't Jennifer, and it wasn't a dream. Somehow, in his sleep, he had come downstairs. He was awake now, lying naked on the cold kitchen floor, clutching with both hands the thing he dug up in the garden, letting it bite him. Edwin managed to sit up and hurl the thing away from him, but he knew with a horrible, sick feeling that it was much too late. The damage, whatever it was, had been well and truly done. He was covered in red lumps, the smallest no worse than mosquito bites, largest almost the size of golf balls. There were two of those on his hairy chest, a bizarre parody of a woman's breasts. Swallowing his sickness, Edwin forced himself to touch one of the swellings. It was hard, almost as if it were a golf ball beneath the skin. But despite his squeamishness, it wasn't painful. He could see the one on his nose without the aid of a mirror, and he knew he must look like a clown with a big red ball for a nose. "Well, at least it doesn't hurt," he said, touching the end of his nose with a fingertip. And then the lump burst beneath his finger, and then it did hurt. Something came out of the lump when it burst, but Edwin couldn't see what it was for the involuntary tears of pain that filled his eyes. When he could see again, he saw a creature like a tiny terrapin, head and four rudimentary limbs protruding from a mottled brown shell. There were differences, but it was recognizably the same sort of creature as the thing he had dug up in his garden. Blood or some other liquid dripped down his face. Shakily, Edwin made his way to the kitchen sink to clean himself, but while he was doing so, one of the lumps on his chest burst. His knees buckled with the pain, and as he went down, he banged his head on the sink, almost, but unfortunately not quite, hard enough to knock himself out. Lying on the floor in a daze of pain and dread, Edwin set himself counting the lumps on his body. They were increasing in size. He didn't need to touch them to know that, and it was obvious that when they reached some critical circumference, they burst, and the creature inside was born. He counted 12 when one of the two on his left hand exploded, making further counting or any sort of coherent thought temporarily impossible. But when he had recovered, Edwin continued his grim exploration with as much determination as if, by knowing the worst, he could somehow change things. There were 20 left. They were bursting at 5 or 6 minute intervals. Edwin decided there was no point in even trying to phone for help. A doctor, presuming he could get one to come out, could give him some painkillers, perhaps, but wouldn't be able to change what was happening. The only thing for it, Edwin thought, was to endure. He kept careful count of each emerging terrapin, for he wanted to know when it was finally over. the next 2 hours were the longest and most terrible in his life. But when it was finally over, despite his sickening exhaustion and physical misery, Edmund felt a kind of triumph, not merely because it was over and he had survived, but also because it had occurred to him that this creature he had dug up in his garden, these creatures that had come out of his body, was the end of the world as he had known it. These creatures were invaders from another planet, and they were going to bring about the downfall of civilization. He looked at them, his 23 alien creatures, crawling about on the linoleum, snapping at each other with razor-sharp teeth, and he almost smiled. Painfully, Edwin hauled himself to his feet and went and opened the back door. Then he fetched the original shell and bowled it out into the garden. One of the babies noticed and scurried outside. "Curious," said Edwin. He held the door open and watched as two more creatures ventured out into the wide world. "Go on," said Edwin. "Plenty of room for everyone. A whole new world to conquer. Go on, outside." Three more made their way across the threshold into the garden, their mode of progress a curious cross between a slide and a waddle. Edwin waited, speaking encouragingly, but at least half of them paid no attention, showing no interest in leaving the kitchen, and eventually he grew impatient. He fetched the broom and swept them out, sneering at them when they snapped ineffectually up at him. "Go now, while it's still dark," he said. "London is sleeping. It's yours. This is your only chance. Once they wake up, they'll kill you. You're easy enough to crush when you're so small. I could smash the lot of you now with this broom, but I won't. I'm a collaborator." "Didn't expect that, did you? Didn't know you'd find somebody willing to help you colonize this planet. Now hurry up. Go on, before I change my mind. Go find somebody else to bite." When they were all inside, he locked the door from habit and stumbled upstairs. He paused in the bathroom to clean himself up. One glimpse of himself in the mirror told him more than he wanted to know. He looked like an ambulatory corpse covered with raw, festering wounds. He couldn't bear the thought of taking a bath, so he cleaned himself gingerly with a flannel. He had mostly stopped bleeding, but his wounds were seeping some other colorless fluid. He hoped it was a healthy reaction, for even if it was something he should try to stop, he didn't have the faintest idea how, and besides, he was nearly asleep on his feet. Edwin Beale fell into sleep almost as he fell into bed, and he slept like the dead. Some hours later, some way into the morning, the sound of breaking glass woke him. He opened his eyes but lay still, too tired and groggy even to try to move glass. A window? The sound had come from downstairs. Someone had broken a window, broken in. He told himself to get up and prepare to repel the intruder, but his body did not respond. Edwin blinked in frustration and came more fully awake. Conscious now, he tried to move his arm and could not, nor could he move either leg. Yet he could feel the muscles flexing and straining. He wasn't incapable or paralyzed, but he was bound in some way. With tremendous effort, Edwin managed to raise his head, and he saw the fine, strong cords that bound him to the bed. Not cords at all, really, but something that looked like dead mucus. It was the stuff that had seeped out of his wounds. One strand of it from his nose looped across his cheek and ear, tugging his head back to the bed so that it was only by straining to the utmost that he managed to achieve a rather lopsided view of his trussed body. His neck muscles ached. With a groan, Edwin let his head fall back onto the pillow. He could hear them on the stairs, a clumping, slithering sound as they knocked together and some of them fell back. Stairs must be difficult for them. They were probably annoyed that he hadn't stayed put. Why should they bother to seek new worlds until they had used up the old one? Edwin wondered how much they ate and how quickly. He wondered how long he would survive. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.